So you want to make sure your names are on these and send them this away. So if you're still having trouble with these, there's kind of an hour worth of examples that are online in that lecture section, right? So those are screencasts that go over the details of lots of examples, including an example that's fairly similar to this one. So the starting point for the first question, what's the altitude that the star is going to transit at, is to draw the meridian, because by definition, transiting is crossing that circle, right? So the meridian is the line in the sky that goes from north through the north celestial pole, maybe through zenith and back through south. So here's north, here's south, here's zenith, and here I am sitting under the meridian. Now the one thing that's different about this problem compared to the other ones we've talked about is this is in the southern hemisphere, right? So usually the north celestial pole has been inclined at our latitude. And that's still the case, but our latitude is negative. So the north celestial pole is going to be down there someplace, right? 40 degrees below the horizon, which means that the south celestial pole is going to be 40 degrees above the southern horizon, right? So here's the north celestial pole. We can't see it. 40 degrees below the horizon. And the celestial equator, perpendicular to this line, is going to miss zenith by the latitude. Now the star we're talking about is towards the south celestial pole, 60 degrees from the celestial equator. So we need to go this way, 61 degrees, and that's where Alpha Centauri is. Okay, so the angle we want is the angle above the nearest horizon, which we can see is that angle. It's the southern horizon. And once you have this diagram, there are lots of ways of working it. What kind of I see immediately is this angle here I can calculate because it's 61 less 40. Right, so it's going to be 21 degrees. And since this is a right angle, this angle here has to be 90 less that 21 degrees, or 69 degrees. I hear quiet, which is always a bad sign. Questions about that? So the way you work that problem is you draw the meridian, you locate the north celestial pole at the latitude. In this case, the north celestial pole is below the horizon because we're talking about southern hemisphere. And then you locate the star relative to the celestial equator. You draw the picture and then you calculate the angle.
I guess I'm having trouble with the latitude. Mm-hmm. Because negative 40 degrees of latitude, if you're looking at it below, it's just 40 degrees.
Yep, southern hemisphere, right? New Zealand was my example.
Yeah, but the way you're doing it here, and I guess it's different because we're looking at just a sky view, is that it's 40 degrees up. I just don't see how.
So I'm not sure what you mean by sort of 40 degrees up. It's 40 degrees down, I would say. So as you go to the right, so in our sky, the Polaris is here, right? 45 degrees. As you walk towards the equator, Polaris gets closer and closer and closer to the horizon. As you step over the equator, Polaris goes below the horizon, and as you go further and further south, it gets further and further below the horizon. And of course, the same time Polaris drops below the horizon, the south celestial pole, there happens not to be a bright star where the south celestial pole is, but the south celestial pole pops up above the horizon. More questions? Okay, so the other part is exactly like it's always been. Right? Doesn't matter whether we're in New Zealand or in Northern Hemisphere, we work this problem the same. From the date, we're going to figure out where the sun is, and then we're going to follow the meridian along at a rate of 1 hour of right ascension per hour of time until we hit the right ascension that is the right ascension of Alpha Centauri, 14 hours, 39 minutes. So how do we figure out where the sun is? Well, we've memorized that table from long ago that gives the right ascension declination of the sun on the four standard dates, the two equinoxes and the two solstices. So December 21 is the date that's closest to this. That's a solstice. For us, it's a winter solstice. In the southern hemisphere, it would be a summer solstice. And what we remember is that the sun is right there, right? At 18 hours right ascension. And the sun moves 24 hours of right ascension in 12 months. So in 1 month, it's going to move 2 hours. So on January 21, the sun is going to be located at 20 hours right ascension, right about there. Okay, so at noon, this is where the meridian is. And it's going to move at a rate of 1 hour of right ascension per hour of time. Or if you want, the celestial sphere is going to rotate by our meridian. It's the same effect, right? And we could go forward if we wanted to, but it's a long way to 14 hours. It's going to be easier to work our way backwards to figure out where the meridian was at 11 a.m., 10 a.m., 9 a.m., etc., until we reach 14 hours. Let's do the latter. So we make this table, right, which is the time of day versus the right ascension that's on the meridian. The one fixed point is noon. The sun should be on the meridian at noon, and the sun has a right ascension of 20 hours on 21 January. So at 11 a.m., this is going to be 19 hours. At 10 a.m., this is going to be 18 hours. At 9 a.m., this is going to be 17 hours, 16, 15, 14. So this is going to be 8 a.m., 7 a.m., 6 a.m. And we wanted 14:39. And so that's going to happen at 6:39 a.m. Okay. So take a look at those screencasts that give lots more examples if you're having problems with the culmination quiz. More questions?
Does it also work for that if you take 0 hours at November 21st and then add time? I think I got the same answer.
So there are lots of ways of working it, and I guess since it's an hour of time per hour of time, what I worry about is they're kind of odd things that happen at 24 and 0, and I hesitate to give you a formula because, in fact, no single formula works on all of these cases. So I think you're best off, for the latitude problem, drawing the picture, not trying to remember, add this number, subtract that number, because there is no formula like that works all the time. And I think the same thing is true of this right ascension and declination. There isn't. You need to remember how the circular nature of time, one way or the other, that after 24 is zero. Well, 24 is the same as zero. Okay. So if you getting the right answer is helpful for getting credit, but I do want to see some sort of work. But if I see work that makes sense to me, like you're subtracting hours, then and it would work more or less in general, then I'd still give you credit for it. You don't have to draw this chart, in short, if you found a way that will work. More questions? Well, let's, before we take a look at the review board. Let's take a look at the quiz that was due, because I don't know if you're like previous classes, this was not an easy quiz for you. So there are kind of more questions here than there were on the quiz formulation, but let's just kind of look at it. So from this diagram, what is the approximate latitude? Yeah, something like 45 degrees, right? So we have to imagine for this guy what the angle is going up to the North Celestial Pole. And it looks pretty much like the North Celestial Pole is splitting the difference between zenith and north. So I don't know, something like 45 degrees in the Northern Hemisphere, obviously, is what that is. The sun is setting, right? So this is a matter of recognizing these labels on the meridian. And generally speaking, the sun is going to be setting in the west all the time. This particular sun, you can see, is setting a little bit south of west. And that in itself is a hint about what the day is. Because in the summer, the sun is going to be rising and setting north of its usual places. In the winter, it's going to be rising and setting south of its usual places, right? And be correspondingly above the horizon less or more. So the sun is always on the equator, meridian, ecliptic. Well, so this is the celestial equator. This is the ecliptic where the sun is, and the sun is always on the ecliptic. The meridian is the line that goes the other way, and so the sun will be on the meridian at noon, but it's not always on the meridian. The approximate date. So we know that it's, you know, quote unquote winter. It's between September 21 and March 21, but how close is it to those various dates? And for this, it's kind of helpful to remember how the whole system works, right? So the whole system works every day. The whole celestial sphere is going to rotate, so stuff rises in the east and sets in the west. But slowly, 1 degree per day, the sun is going the other way, right? So the sun is going this way on this map, but this whole map is turning that way once a day. So in a few days, the sun is going to be at an equinox. And it better be a spring equinox, because we're going from winter to summer. So I don't know, February 21, something like that. We're far from a solstice, so it better not be December 21. Okay, so the phases of the moon on these various situations, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I hope 4 is the most obvious. In that case, the sun is in the opposite direction of the moon. So if we were looking at it, we would see the fully illuminated face of the moon, so that moon would be full. As we go to smaller and smaller angles, so we're talking about the angle between the sun and this guy in one of these moons, as we go to smaller and smaller angles, the illuminated surface of the moon is going to get less and less and less. So here we're talking about a mostly illuminated first surface. These are gibbous moons. Here we're talking about seeing half of a moon, because the angle between the sun and this guy in that spot is 90 degrees. So that's going to be a quarter phase. This is going to be a little bitty moon, a crescent phase. Okay, but that doesn't actually help answer the question, because not uncommonly the question gave, so like for example for this crescent moon, the question gave lots of crescent moons. And the question was, how is the crescent oriented? And you remember that the crescent has to be pointing at the sun. So if you put yourself in the place of this guy, we have the sun setting here. And on that picture, it looks like the moon is to the right of the sun. But to the guy, the moon is going to be to the left of the sun, right? Because things are reversed for you and me. Yes. So that doesn't affect what the phase of the moon is. So the moon has a phase whether we can see it or not.
Yeah, but if the Earth's in between the moon,
Oh, you mean exactly between?
Well, I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah. So we only have eclipses very, very occasionally, right? And that's because remember that the moon is a pretty small object, and the shadow of the Earth is a pretty small object, so it's very unlikely for them to be aligned. They're only aligned twice per year.
Right, so moon 4 is visible.
Yeah, so moon 4 is within 5 degrees of the ecliptic, you know, which is about that much. Okay, so we were working on moon 1, and we said that to us it looks like moon 1 is to the right of the sun, but because of the reversal that you get when you're facing each other, moon 1 is going to be to the left of the sun. And that means we're looking for a crescent phase, kind of like that. So remember that you can think about this as kind of like being a bow and an arrow, and that arrow should point towards the sun. Another way of saying the same thing is the straight line between the moon and the sun is approximately the ecliptic. Right? So if we were, again, to draw this from that guy's point of view, the ecliptic would look kind of like that, and so the phase of the moon has to be perpendicular to that ecliptic. So moon 2, of course, is going to be a half moon, right? Something like that. Moon 3 is the one that gives people usually the most trouble. So we know that the white has to be aiming towards the sun, and the white has to be aiming along the ecliptic. And notice that the ecliptic at the location of moon 3 is pointing up. Right? The straight line path between moon 3 and the sun is not down, it's up. So even though the sun is low on the horizon, we have to go up to reach it in the shortest possible distance. And it's like if you travel to Europe, which is east of here, you don't go east, right? You go northeast. The short line distance, the great circle route is up and over. So that sort of moon, it's going to have a little bit of dark, and it's going to have its white pointing up and over in the direction of the ecliptic. Okay.
One question.
If it were September 1st, the sun would not be visible on this picture. So it would have to be on the other ecliptic, on the other equinox, right? So this is where the sun will be on March 21. And so September 21, it would be the other intersection that we have between the celestial equator and the ecliptic. So it'd be over there. Say again? Yes, so if this were, if I were going to try and draw this for a September 21 date, then the sun would be rising north of the west, right? Because it's still, quote unquote, summer.
But isn't that where it's not,
say again?
That's not where, the sun is not like setting on that side, right? On the west side.
So the sun is setting a little bit south of west, right? Here's west, here's south. Not exactly west, but a little bit south of west. On September, it would be the reverse. The sun would be setting over here. And the ecliptic would be running kind of like this, down around over there. Right, we still would have the future of the sun being on the ecliptic on September 21. So something like that would be what the ecliptic would look like. There are lots of reversals. You can think about taking this map and pasting it on the inside surface of this globe with north pointing that way. You can get these same answers. But it takes a little bit of mind flipping in order to make it work. So on September 21, the future location of the sun, and remember, slowly the sun is moving backwards, is going to be south of the celestial equator.
Okay.
So the whole celestial equator is going this way, but the sun is going the other way. So on September 1, which is kind of here, the future location of the sun is south of the celestial equator, whereas the future location of this sun is north of the celestial equator. Which way the sun's goes?
West to east on this?
So this is, there are so many reversals that it gets confusing. So when I talk about the sun moving on the celestial sphere, I'm not talking about it rising and setting every day, right? Because the stars don't move on the celestial sphere, but they do rise and set just like the sun does. So the sun is moving very slowly, 1 degree per day, in the opposite direction that the sphere rotates. And that's why it takes one rotation, 23 hours, 56 minutes, and a little bit more to get the sun back to where it was before at noon, namely on the meridian. Okay, so the sun is fighting the general trend. It's above the horizon more than it would be otherwise if it were just a star. And this gets kind of doubly confusing. Kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but let me point out the confusion now. Retrograde motion. So retrograde motion sounds like motion that's in the opposite direction that the sphere is rotating, right? But it's not, right? Because what it really means is the opposite direction that the sun is moving, and the sun is moving the opposite way the sphere is rotating. So retrograde motion is motion the same way the celestial sphere is turning. Again, it's a slow motion. It doesn't have anything to do with the 24-hour rotation. So we've got reversals between you and me because we're facing different directions. We got reversals of all of these stuff. It's hard to remember. And kind of unfortunately, remembering something like it's the opposite of what you think is always a dangerous thing to do, right? Because maybe you already thought the right answer. More questions? So here's the lineup. We're going to finish reading chapter 4 in the textbook. We've got another one of these online quizzes to work. This one's called Martian Moons. Exam 1 is in 8 days. By far the best way to study for the exam is to look at the old exams, right? So there's an exact same exam for the same class given a year ago. You can take a look at that. Your exam won't be identical to that, but it'll have lots of very similar stuff. Furthermore, it turns out that the other class, Astronomy 211, starts out the same. So if you look at the exam that was given last spring, which is also online, it'll also be similar to your exam. So you got two kind of example exams to work at. And my recommendation is to actually work that exam yourself. And you can bring in your answers, and I'm happy to kind of grade it in front of you, and we can talk about those answers. Or if you want, there's a screencast that gives you the answers to those to the exam. So you can listen to me talk and draw diagrams and give the answers to all of those exams that are online. But, you know, my recommendation is person to person is going to work better. So I know it always seems to turn out that these deadlines occur when it starts to get hard to observe the sky. I think you could have observed it on Sunday if you were diligent and kind of didn't give up too early. So I've extended this. It looks like we're in for a cloudy streak according to the weather, but supposedly on the weekend it'll clear up again. So I've extended the deadline. It'll be the last extension, even if it's cloudy. You know, we have to call an end eventually is Monday, September 26th. So you know you're supposed to scan your diagrams and email them to me or have me look over them in person to kind of mark the start of this process. Questions? I think 3 people have turned it in so far. So my plan is for the next Thursday's, I guess, quiz to be on the vocab. And that'll be a quiz similar to the one that's online in the sense it'll be matching. So I won't ask you to define ecliptic. I'll have ecliptic on one side and I'll have a definition of lots of things including the ecliptic, and it's a matter of picking out the correct definition. And that'll be a moderately high point quiz because there are a fair number of questions there, like a 20-point quiz. More questions? Okay, so the plan has been to, without trying to invent reasons for why the sky works the way it does, to just try and list the way the sky works. And then today and maybe tomorrow we can talk about the why that it works the way it does. So kind of the starting point is almost everything. You know, 5,000 visible stars, the book says 3,000 visible stars. Take your pick. There are, of course, really billions of stars. All the stars that you can see pretty much are doing this very regular thing. They're moving exactly uniformly around the North Celestial Pole, making one full rotation in 23 hours, 56 minutes. Now, the celestial pole is gradually moving, but you know, in your lifetime, it's going to be very close to Polaris. If you go back thousands of years, then the North Celestial Pole was there. But there's a circle on the SCO-02 that shows you the past and future path of the North Celestial Pole. Okay, so the drifting of the North Celestial Pole is not obvious, but it was discovered by the Greeks, I don't know, 200 BC or something, long ago. So it's kind of noticeable. Now, unfortunately, the exceptions to this rule, you know, the seven exceptions, are actually pretty bright and obvious objects. So it's kind of the dim things that are doing regular stuff. So the most obvious object is, of course, the sun. And the sun is moving along the ecliptic, not exactly uniformly, but slightly different uniformly. So as a result, these standard dates that we've been talking about that sound like they're equally spaced, 21 March, 21 June, 21 September, 21 December, sounds like they're the same number of days. But in fact, the sun is moving extra fast around here, so the season from solstice to spring equinox is actually the shortest. Again, it's a subtle effect, but it was well known to the Greeks. So the moon moves a lot faster. Instead of completing one rotation per year, it completes one rotation per month. And we can distinguish sidereal and synoptic if we want. But the path that it's on is not the ecliptic. It's inclined a little bit to the ecliptic. It's a great circle, so it has two intersection points with the ecliptic. Those are called the nodes. But that orientation of that path is gradually changing over an 18-year cycle. So those intersection points are slowly changing. And of course, the only place we can have eclipses are when the Earth, Sun, and Moon are lined up. So that requires the Sun and the Moon to be at nodes. So only when we have eclipse seasons, when the Sun is at one of those nodes, can we have either a solar or a lunar eclipse. Lunar eclipse if the Moon is at the opposite node, solar eclipse if it's at the same node. Okay, so a subtle effect, but this was figured out by the Greeks, and if you just plot the times of these eclipses, there's a pretty obvious pattern that doesn't take a whole lot of thought to make out, right? So here are the eclipses, and you can see they're happening earlier in the year every year as the nodes gradually move on this 18-year cycle. Okay, so perfectly regular, almost regular, kind of regular. And as we go along, we get kind of increasingly irregular motion. So the inferior planets, those are Venus and Mercury, they have kind of a funny motion. So if this is the Sun, which is, of course, moving along the ecliptic, the inferior planets are on one side, and then they're on the other side, then they're on this side. They have this kind of back and forth motion around the Sun. So when they're on this side of the Sun, if you just think about rotating this map, they will be visible in the evening sky. And when they're on this side, they'll be visible in the morning sky. So we see the inferior planets, you know, either at sunset, so we might see Mercury closer to the Sun. Mercury has a maximum deviation of the Sun of 30 degrees. Venus has a maximum deviation of about 45 degrees. We see these guys mostly at sunset when they're on the left, or at sunrise when they're on the right. Okay, This makes, incidentally, Mercury pretty hard to get good observations of because it's never very far from the Sun. But you can get good locations. The ancients had good locations for Venus. Okay, so the other planets, which to the ancients were Mars through Saturn, they're the bright planets, they have, I don't know if you want to call it more or less regular motion. So first of all, they're going slower. Venus and Mercury, on average, are keeping up with the Sun, right? Sometimes they're ahead, sometimes behind, but over any long period of time, they have the same sort of motion as the Sun. The superior planets are moving slower than the Sun. They're moving the same direction as the Sun, but they're moving slower. So if this is how they are initially, in a while they'll be separated. In a while after that, they'll be separated by more because the Sun moves faster than the planet. So we have this sort of, if we start at a conjunction, which is where the planet and the Sun are in the same direction, of course you can't see a conjunction, but it's a nice mathematical starting point. After a while, we're going to get this sort of situation where the planet is on the right of the Sun, with, of course, the Sun in the future moving further than the planet does. So that means this thing is going to be visible in the morning. As time goes on, the angle between that planet and the Sun is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually we'll reach 180 degrees between that planet and the Sun. That's called opposition, kind of the same thing as a full moon. Such a planet would be rising as the Sun is setting, and setting as the Sun is rising. So if we flip over now, as we did for the moon, and talk about things at sunset, such a planet at opposition would be rising as the Sun is setting. Say again?
Do it like, are there, does it reach at any point in time where all the planets line up in a straight line like you see on the diagram? Their orbit is small. Like you talk about the kind of lining up ions that would do that. Not that.
Yeah. So let me kind of back up. So you're saying, does it ever happen that Jupiter is here and Saturn's there and Uranus there, is Neptune there, etc.? And let me first kind of rephrase your question in a different way, right? If that's the case, if they're all in a line in the actual fit picture, which is this, that means they're going to be at the same spot on the celestial sphere. And they're all moving at different rates, so it's unlikely to happen, but yeah, it happens. And I think there was a big lineup of most of the planets, but maybe not Pluto. Of course, Pluto's not a planet anymore. But there is a big lineup of most of the planets in the 90s. And when I say in the same direction, all of these guys are missing the ecliptic by a little bit. So they're not, you know, one dot. You know, it's just a cluster of them in more or less the same, say, constellation. Yeah, so they're going at different rates. There's nothing to keep them from lining up. When this was predicted to happen, people said, oh, it's going to be terrible because all of these planets are going to be having some tremendous gravitational influence on the Earth, and it's going to disrupt things. And you may have noticed that nothing interesting happened in the 90s, so it's nothing bad happened. Probably you don't have to worry a whole lot about 2012 either, although maybe you do.
Why only if I do? Is it because it's so small?
Say again? So there's a legislative body called the International Astronomical Union, and you know they don't, you know, they're not actually, they might have some standing in the UN, but in any case they have a standing in their own minds, and they declared it out. So I guess your question is, were they just acting arbitrarily because they didn't like Pluto? Or were they acting with some reasonable logic? And the kind of principal cause for demotion of Pluto was the finding of three or four other objects that were bigger than Pluto, or at least they thought were bigger than Pluto, were kind of, at worst, were only slightly smaller than Pluto. So they were facing the prospect of not having 9 planets, but having 12, 13, 14, 15 planets. And they didn't want to do that. So Pluto is unusual. If you count it as a planet, it's the smallest planet, it's the most inclined planet, it's of course the furthest out planet. It has a long list of unusual features. So it wasn't terrible to exclude it as a planet. Incidentally, this is a repetition of what happened to the what we now call the asteroid Sirius. So Sirius was originally discovered as one of these wanderers, not a particularly bright wanderer. And they said, well, it's a wanderer, and therefore it's a planet. So suddenly we had a new planet. I think at that time we didn't have Uranus and Neptune. So maybe it was the whatever number that is, sixth planet or something like that. But then they discovered lots of other objects more or less like Ceres. And, you know, do we have 12 planets, 100 planets, 1,000 planets? There are literally millions of objects in the asteroid belt. So we had to have kind of some lower limit to describe the end of the planets. If you want to, you can still call Pluto a planet, and I probably will, because officially it's a dwarf planet. So it's still a planet. It's just not a major planet anymore. There are lots of people who object to this because the logic that, so Pluto is unusual in lots of regards, but the things that they pointed to for Pluto kind of really don't make sense when you examine them. So I think the real answer is they just didn't want 12, 13, 14 planets. So it's easier to have 8 planets. And it may also have played a role that the Astronomical Union is dominated by Europeans, and Pluto was the one planet that was discovered by an American, at least that's what I think. No. Nope. Yeah, so that's kind of a common misnomer that those things were all together as one planet. And if you put all of this stuff together, it turns out it's not any bigger than Pluto. So there's not enough material to make a planet. And so not only is there not enough material, we don't think that there was that it was ever together. It's stuff that was never put together into a planet. So presumably, at one time, the whole solar system was filled with junk like the asteroid belt, and that stuff got together to form a planet. And basically, because of the influence of Jupiter, this stuff was stirred up enough that it never got together to form a planet. Incidentally, we have space probes that are currently orbiting one of these asteroids and are going to go on to Ceres in a few years. So we'll have good Vesta is what it's currently orbiting. And so you can look at pictures of one of I think it's the second or third biggest asteroid. And then it'll go on to the biggest asteroid, which was the first one discovered, Ceres, which is also, incidentally, a dwarf planet. So if you want to count Ceres, you can. Back a little bit more to Pluto, one of the reasons Pluto made it as a planet to begin with is it was misestimated. People said that it was more massive and bigger than it turned out to be. So it started out being bigger than the Earth, and then it shrunk as they made more and more observations of it. So it kind of made it onto the list when people thought it was a bigger thing.
Wait, did you say that Sirius is bigger than Pluto?
No, it's pretty comparable, but it is smaller. And in fact, most of these things that they thought were bigger than Pluto, they now think are probably smaller than Pluto. So I think it's true that we don't know of any non-major planet that is smaller than... Yeah, I'm not sure I'm saying it right, but you know what I mean. Pluto seems to be the biggest of this group. But, you know, we're talking about out of literally kilometers, out of thousands of kilometers. So it's a very tight thing. And it could still reverse one way or the other. And there almost certainly are objects that are undiscovered that are bigger than Pluto, but probably not a lot bigger than Pluto. So Pluto seems to be one of a class of what are called Kuiper belt objects, which is kind of like a new version of the asteroid belt. More questions? Okay, so we got the superior planets. So they're mostly just moving slow. The one thing that's a little bit tricky is they have this retrograde motion in the middle of their path. And again, what retrograde motion is not something that's obvious. It just means that if you look in detail, instead of this planet moving steadily in one direction, it has a little backward sidestep. And the size of these sidesteps are usually smaller than a constellation, so it's a pretty small deal. But here's actual data, kind of as you would interpret it for Jupiter and Mars. Jupiter is the most obvious one that's here for, you can see that Mars has a backward stretch too. We've got these retrograde loops. And they happen once a year, basically once a year when the planet is in opposition. So when the planet is brightest, which is in opposition, it's also moving the opposite way the sun is moving, which is the same way the celestial sphere is moving. Okay. And we started to at least add vocabulary words for the so-called geocentric model of the solar system. And here's kind of the picture the Greeks came up with. So the Greeks said, and we probably won't get much further than this today, what the Greeks said is that the Earth is the center of the universe, hence the name geocentric, and the planets are all on these kind of crystalline spheres. So the line that connects the Earth to the Sun, so this is a mathematical line, it also holds the center of this suborbit of Venus. So as the Sun orbits, it's pulling the center of this orbit of Venus around, and Venus is going around like that. So there are names for these things. The main path of this thing here for Venus, that's the deferent. This little circular guy on top of it is the epicycle. For the superior planets, there's no connection between the center of their kind of orbits and their epicyclic motion. But here's Mars, the center of this thing would be going this way, and this whole thing would be spinning around that way, which would make the retrograde motions that we in fact observe for the superior planets. Okay? Now there are more details here. So the motions of all of these things are circles. That is to say, this deferent we're saying is a perfect circle, and this epicycle we're saying is a perfect circle. But you remember that we know that the Sun doesn't have exactly uniform motion. Sometimes it's going a little bit faster than other times. So we invent a way to deal with this that is called the equant. So here is the center of the deferent. And the idea is we're going to place the Earth a little bit off center, and we're going to place this other point, which is the equant, an equal distance from the center that the Earth is. And then we're going to claim that these planets are pushed along uniformly from the equant point. Okay, and what that means, let me draw it on the board. What that means, if you think about it, so here's the equant point, and the Earth would be over there. I won't bother to sketch it. I'd like a bigger stick if I can find it. I don't see it. I really want one. And there should be one. Anyone spot the meter stick? Ah! I'm sure it was used to beat a student recently. It just left there. So if you think about the consequences of this thing turning at a uniform rate in a circle like this, when we're out on the edge of that point, it's moving faster than points that are near the center. So that means that the planet is going to be moving slow because it's close to the equant there, but over here, it's further out, so it's going to be moving faster. So the actual miles per hour that the planet is moving is going to change. And not only that, in this case, the Earth is far from that slow-moving planet, so the angle that it's moving is going to seem relatively small. Whereas here, the Earth is relatively close to this fast-moving planet, and so it's going to seem to be moving even faster. So we've got those two things going for us. Literally, the miles per hour of the planet are going to change, and we're going to be far from the planet when it's going slow, and we're going to be close to the planet when it's going fast. So those things combine to give you the slow-fast motion of the Sun. And then we play that game for all of the other planets. Right? So we have the center of each one of these circles, say for Mars, is here, and we have an equant and the Earth off-center from that. Okay, so I don't know if you would call that a complicated system or not, but it's pretty much what you require if you're going to have this sort of loop-to-loop motion, right? It's the most obvious sort of explanation for the apparent backward motions of the superior planets. And it works pretty well. It's certainly good enough to predict the constellation that those planets are going to be in 1,000 years from now. It's not up to figuring out where the planet is going to be, say, to within the size of the moon, to within half a degree. It's off by a little bit. So, here's a long list of funny names, and usually the first question that people ask is, which one of these names do I need to know for the exam? We're going to talk about these people, but the answer to that question is, as liberal arts students, you got to know who Plato and Aristotle are. I'm probably not going to talk a lot about them, but I will not be at all upset to use their names on an exam. Every educated person should know who those guys are. Right? Just like all of you should know who Saint Benedict is, right? And Ptolemy is the other really important name on this list. And the other names won't occur on exams. So I think probably the first thing to notice from this list, so you also see these dates, and I'm never going to ask you to memorize dates, but I do need you to be able to put things in order. And so, you should know roughly when people lived and died in order to understand that, you know. So my brother-in-law famously asked his mother, whether she voted for Lincoln or Douglas. Which is funny on lots of regards. So you need to have some idea of roughly what the time frame is for these guys. So with that in mind, the first thing that you should notice is the huge span of time we're talking about. Right, so we're talking about 500 years of history, right? We're talking about the equivalent of back to 1492. So all sorts of things happened during this so-called Greek era, which includes a good bit of Roman era. So, you might notice a name that's not on this list, and that's Socrates, which is another name that you should know a lot about. One of the reasons I didn't put Socrates on this list is we don't know a lot about Socrates. We don't literally know a lot about Socrates. Everything we know about Socrates was written by Plato, and it's not entirely clear that Plato was putting the words in Socrates' mouth that were actually Socrates' words or whether they were Plato's words. So Plato was a student of Socrates, and Aristotle was a student of Plato, and Eudoxus was also another student of Plato. So we're talking about people who overlapped each other a little bit in time and kind of the start of philosophy. And philosophy at this time is going to include science. It's going to include explanations for everything. And Aristotle is the guy who came up with the explanation for everything. So these days, you can emphasize that lots of explanations that Aristotle came up with are in detail wrong, but they're astoundingly comprehensive and pretty good. And they're going to explain, I think, a lot of the reasons why people had these kind of maybe potentially funny ideas about how the sky worked. So if we start talking just about astronomy, Plato was really the first guy to give hints about the way the universe worked. And Plato was thinking that there was an ideal world that was kind of behind the physical world. And in this ideal world, mathematics was kind of true. And so he kind of noticed that the vast majority of things have perfectly regular motion. They're on circles. And so he postulated that circular motion, exactly uniform circular motion, was kind of the nature of this ideal world that's behind the physical world. He didn't work out the details. He left that to his student, Eudoxus. So Eudoxus got down to the dirty details and figured out what combination of circular motion would actually cause the observed motions. Okay, so it's one thing to say, well, I bet a bunch of circles would work, and it's another thing to actually crank out the set of circles that would actually make, you know, this kind of crazy motion for which there was detailed measurements. You know, how big does this circle need to be? How fast does the circle need to turn? A good start on that was made by Eudoxus. So Aristotle's up there in the Hall of Fame of philosophers because, as I said, he had an overriding explanation for everything. And I think probably the thing that is strangest about this whole system to modernize is the idea that the whole universe is spinning around the Earth. You know, Jupiter's a big place, we say. Why is it that it's going around us? The sun is even bigger. Why is it going around us? So the first important separation you need to make if you're going to get into the mindset of these ancients is the idea that there is a huge difference between heaven and earth. Nothing that applied on earth really applied in the heavens. So the heavens, we had the kind of the fundamental mathematical nature of the universe revealed in perfect motion. On earth, we have, you know, a cesspool. We have a lot of corruption and things live and die, as opposed to these motions which seem to go on forever. So the idea is Earth is not a particular, Earth is not the center of the universe because it's, you know, a great place. Earth is the center of the universe because it's a cesspool, it's the drainage ditch. Things are great once you get away from the Earth. So this is made manifest in what things are actually made out of. So I'm sure you're familiar with the four elements of the universe as defined by Aristotle, right? Earth, air, water, and fire. And kind of the idea was that there was a natural place for these things. So Earth was heavy and it fell to the center of the universe and it made the rock that we called the Earth. Right? The air was lighter, so it was going to float above the Earth. So there's a natural explanation for how things work based on this sort of material. So these sorts of elements were subject to corruption. That's, you know, why things live and die here on Earth. But once we get above the lunar orbit, then things are totally different. We're not made out of these four elements. We're made out of the quintessence, the fifth element. Quintessence. And the quintessence is perfect, mathematically perfect. It has no mass. So it doesn't matter that Jupiter is a relatively big object. It has no problems spinning around because it doesn't weigh anything. It's going to move in these mathematically perfect circles because that's the way the universe fundamentally works once we get away from the corruption that is the cesspool that is Earth. So we expect perfect motion. And the fact that these seven guys are exceptions are indicative of the fact that, you know, they're kind of corrupted a little bit by being close to the Earth. The more distant stars are doing the most perfect stuff. And of course, it's kind of no surprise that the closest things are going to be the brightest things. Okay. So Aristotle has I'm just talking about his astronomy, but he wrote books on politics and biology. You know, he had an explanation for everything that's in a modern university. And if you trace back the origins of most any discipline at a university, you'll find Aristotle at close to the start of those organizations. He obviously didn't get everything right, but he started lots of stuff. So Aristarchus. So Aristarchus makes my list of important people because a moment ago I was saying that Jupiter is bigger than the Earth and so therefore it's a little bit problematical that it's moving. Well, how do we know the size of those objects? Those things are just dots. How do we know that they are different sizes? So Aristarchus was actually the first guy to use geometry to figure out the sizes of these objects. Again, not perfectly, because observations were difficult, but he knew that the relative size of the Earth and the Moon, he knew that the Sun was a whole lot bigger than the Moon. He had an idea for the relative scale of the solar system. Again, he put the Sun way too close, so it was more comparable to the Earth than it would be today, but he certainly knew that the Sun was way bigger than the Earth and the Moon, and yet seemed to be going around in circles. And so that you know, kind of perplexed him. The bigger thing really should be the stationary thing. So Aristarchus noticed that you could kind of connect the dots differently and have exactly the same phenomena. So we kind of arbitrarily declare the Earth to be the thing that is stationary. Let's arbitrarily conclude that the Sun is the thing that's stationary. Is that a question? Or? So you're saying the size of the Sun. So the mass of the Sun is going to mostly not change, but there is something called the solar wind that is slowly losing mass. So over time, the Sun is losing mass a little bit. But what the immediate future of the Sun is that it's going to increase in its radius. And eventually it's going to expand quite big. It's probably going to engulf the Earth. So the Earth will be inside the radius of the Sun. Then after that, it's actually going to shrink down to something that's comparable in size to the Earth.
So, but like 2,000 years ago, not as much?
Oh, these things require billions of years to change. Yeah, so... people have been interested in measuring with high precision the size of the Sun for the last 200 years, and we see in the numbers that it hasn't changed at all in that time. And we're not expecting it to change except over kind of billions of years. So the big expansion of the Sun is scheduled for 5 billion years in the future. There is this slow, gradual expansion of the Sun that is going to be problematic for life on Earth, but not because we get engulfed by the Sun, but just because when the Sun gets bigger, it's going to get brighter. So in about a billion years, it looks bad for life on Earth. Probably the oceans will boil and things like that. But the actual real climatic end, where maybe the Earth melts when it's inside the Sun, that's scheduled for 5 billion years. And we'll talk lots more about that in, I don't know, months. More questions? Say again?
So hopefully there's no good resources left for that.
Well, I don't know. There's conservation of mass, right? So the amount of carbon in the Earth isn't being used up. It's just being cycled around. Incidentally, kind of the problem is really the reverse, at least from kind of a scientific point of view. So if you run the equation backwards, that means 4 billion years ago when the Earth formed, the Sun was smaller and dimmer. And it's kind of hard to figure out how the oceans melted. Because if you have a ice-covered planet, it's going to be very reflective. It's not going to absorb much of the Sun's heat. So why did the Earth ever melt? So this is called the ice ball problem. And it's not exactly solved. So the sun was noticeably dimmer 4 billion years ago, kind of when it all started. For sure, yeah, the Earth will become absolutely uninhabitable, and the further out, the better.
So if we're still around, then we could theoretically just move to Mars for a while.
Yeah, and also, of course, just living in space per se, right? You could build big space stations. A billion years is got a lot of time to plan that one. Yeah, so nothing's going to happen interesting over a period of... Yeah, I got to be careful about saying nothing, right? So there are always things happening, and prediction of the future is difficult. But it doesn't look like anything interesting is going to happen in thousands of years.
Although we're getting a bus-sized, like old satellite supposed to fall this week at some random time.
Yeah, but of course that's not adding mass to the Earth. That was mass that was on the Earth that was flung up there, and now it's coming down, right? So it's just been flying around for an unusually large period of time.
It's just really funny how they worded it. Like sometime in the next week, we don't know where or when, a bus-sized like old satellite will be entering Earth's orbit, and I'm not sure where it's going to land, but there's like a 1 in 32 million of a chance of it hitting a person. So
Just like this is totally like this guy is like not even, I don't know, it's just really funny. Yeah.
Yeah, just think how much money you'd make if it destroys your house, though, because you could sell all that material on eBay. So, I don't know, you should hope that it happens to your neighbor, I guess. So, I mean, stuff is hitting the Earth all the time, right? There are meteorites constantly running into the Earth. Most of those burn up in the atmosphere, but that still adds to the mass of the Earth. Some of it hits. And cars, I know, have been hit. I think maybe people have been hit by falling rocks, but it's extremely rare. And literally thousands of them are falling every day. So it is a long shot. I'm hoping it happens to you. Where do you live so I can pick up the material? Now, you can get good prices for meteorites. And I think one that destroyed a house, you could get a really good price for. So, Aristarchus was the guy who figured out the sizes, and so he came up with a heliocentric model. So it literally works exactly the same way as the geocentric model, because all you're doing is connecting up the dots differently. Right? As long as it's circles moving on circles, it doesn't really matter whether you declare the sun to be at rest or you declare the earth to be at rest, it's still circles. So it's going to have exactly the same predictions. To Aristarchus, it made a little bit more sense because he said the sun is big. But to Aristotle, you know, who cares? The sun, it could be any size. It's made out of the quintessence. It doesn't matter how big it is. So that's maybe something that gets a misnomer that enters into people's grade school education, is that there was some moment of history where people thought that the earth was flat, right? Columbus was worried about sailing over the edge of the earth, and that's not the case. So educated people have always known that the earth was a sphere, going way back before Aristotle. It'd be hard to know how far back you'd have to go. Now maybe the uneducated sailors worried about that, but certainly no one that the kings and queens, no one that Columbus was dealing with was in doubt that the earth was a sphere. So the argument for Columbus was, how big is that sphere? Right? Does it actually make sense to go east by going west? If the sphere is small, then it makes sense. If the sphere is big, then it doesn't make sense. And it turns out that Eratosthenes, who is the next name on the list, had a very accurate estimate for the size of the earth, accurate to within about 1%. So if you believe Eratosthenes, you know that the earth is too big and it doesn't make sense to go west to go east. But Ptolemy, who I'm going to claim is the greatest, he actually has a wrong size for the earth. So there is an ancient disagreement about the size of the earth. And basically what Columbus was arguing is that this was the right size of the earth. It is small. It does make sense to go west to reach the east. And we ignore the measurements that this guy did. Now, it wasn't a crazy argument because, as I'll say, Algimas is actually a translation of the greatest. This guy did pretty good work. Okay, so a little bit more on the Greeks, but the plan is to switch over to talking about when things changed. And so we're talking now about Middle Ages, when people started to believe that the sun really was the center. Aristarchus had said that, but no one believed him.